Chapter 9. Azaz, Syria. The refugee caravan wisely avoided Aleppo, the site of major fighting for well over 2 years. Jane had seen the international wire stories, with photos of bomb-devastated neighborhoods, of total destruction that brought to mind the Allied bombing of Berlin or Dresden. She repressed her emotions when conducting interviews, shared them via Skype with her girlfriend back home. Azaz, they were assured, would be the preferred stopping point before making the transition into Turkey. By now, the refugee caravan had joined many, many others. Jane Houri estimated that 3,000 people were camped out in the perimeter of the fallow farmland outside the town. But Tamer Awad had been checking stories on the net and knew that the refugee population of Azaz was closer to 20,000. "There are other camps dotted all over," he told her that night. "This is one of the smaller ones." Jane interviewed Mohammed and Amira Bakur several times. Theirs was not a snapshot story, she understood. They were on a journey and, if possible, Jane wanted to stay with them until they reached Europe. The parents liked her and had noticed that Mohammed, 15, lost a little of his angry edge as he talked to the young Londoner. Amira, 13, had turned the reporter into some kind of idol. The parents laughed when Amira began pronouncing words with a strange London dialect, mimicking her newfound friend. The Irish Times had picked up 4 of Jane's stories, and to her delight and amazement, a wire service had selected 2 of them, which appeared first in The Guardian, then the Boston Globe. Tamer's photos were amazing and evocative, and the decision to focus on just the Bakur siblings now seemed brilliant. It's impossible for an audience to identify with 20,000 traumatized people camping outside Azaz, but easy to identify with an angry big brother and his shell-shocked little sister. That night, Tamer Awad paid another family for 2 cans of Fresca from an ice chest, and the journalists popped them by moonlight, toasting the cans together. "I'm selling photos to Getty Images," Tamer said with a wicked grin. "Don't tell your uncle, but when we get to Ankara, I'm putting out my resume to every paper in Europe."
"You're not going back to Hama?" Jane asked, nudging his shoulder.
"Your uncle is a great and scholarly man. May the Prophet bless his household, but he pays crap."
"Don't settle for just any paper."
Jane sipped her soda, felt the carbonation tickle her nose.
"You're going to be a staff photographer for the London Times or the New York Times, you'll see."
Tamer grinned in the night.
"You're the big gun here, Jinan."
"Don't think I don't know it. I'm just hitching a ride on your comet."
Jane beamed with pride. She huddled her squall coat around her narrow shoulders.
"Turkey?"
"Tomorrow. There's a Red Cross Red Crescent camp just on the other side of the border, due north on the D-850.
The mayor pointed toward the glow of the highway, which connects northwestern Syria with Turkey.
"It's going to take the family the better part of a day, maybe 2, to get through the checkpoint. I recommend we hustle and get through first and wait for them in the camp."
"Sounds good. Ready for a hike in Turkey?"
"Thankfully, the Quran specifically says that penitent women must always carry the camera bag. I looked it up. Just be grateful I didn't bring tripods."
"It says that, does it?"
She nestled in next to her friend.
"We'll see."
Chapter 10. Nicosia, Cyprus. Lachlan Sumner flew the de Havilland back to the firm's operating base in Kyrenia, where the partners took care of such mundane responsibilities as laundry, and Lachlan restocked the seaplane. Nobody was happy about breaking off the investigation, but the birthday of Fierro's mother wasn't to be missed. Not without reverberations that would last throughout the year. Alejandro Fierro, Catalan's father, was a director of the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, or UNESCO, the agency dedicated to peace and collaboration between nations and protecting the world's cultural sites. He was also executive director of a Spanish philanthropy known as the Galician Trust. He co-owned 2 or 3, or possibly 4, companies, and sat on the boards of directors for a handful of others. Finnegan honestly couldn't keep up on how the patrician Spaniard defined "my job" from week to week. His diverse interests kept him flying constantly from European capital to capital, and he averaged less than a week per month back home in Madrid. Her mother, Khadija Dahar, traveled almost as much and almost never to the same destinations. As a liberal, pro-Euro political academic, who wore the traditional hijab with Saint Laurent,
she'd become a darling of the left, appearing on television and in debates as the new European Muslim woman. Her daughter often thought that the new European Muslim woman was a bit like Cro-Magnon Man, the skeletal remains of a bygone era. But she didn't say that at home. Since none of the three family members could be trusted to appear in Madrid on the same week, Finnegan had suggested they meet in Nicosia, the capital of Cyprus. Fierro objected. She wanted to keep her family as far away from St. Nicholas salvage and wrecking as possible. But Finnegan argued that the capital would suffice. And her parents did know she was living on the island situated in the eastern Mediterranean, like the center pivot of a clock that ticked off time clockwise. Between Greece at 10 o'clock, Turkey, Syria, Lebanon, Israel, and Egypt at 6 o'clock. Nicosia is the last split capital on Earth, like Berlin before it. The south is controlled by the Greece-friendly Cypriot government, while the north is occupied by Turkish troops who invaded in 1974. Of course, Turkish Cypriots often said the south was occupied by Greece. Political affairs are, as usual, a matter of perspective. Drive around Nicosia and you have to cross United Nations checkpoints. Cut through the middle of the capital and you cross the Green Line, a Cypriot border station with Cypriot police in one shack, with all signage in Greek, and 20 paces on, a Turkish border station with Turkish soldiers checking passports. The inner-walled city of Nicosia includes a vibrant pedestrian-only sector stuffed with shops, restaurants, and hotels. On the Greek side, business is vibrant and the foot traffic heavy. The same is true, to a lesser degree, on the Turkish side. But the Turkish side also includes a winding dead zone, gray half-demolished buildings with missing roofs, mortar holes, and the remnants of tank treads, exactly one block wide and running the entire length of the Green Line. No remnants of the 1974 civil war are evident on the Greek side. They're hard to miss on the Turkish side. As neutral territory for a Fierro family reunion, Nicosia couldn't be beat. Alejandro could rhapsodize about the economic potential of the island, and Khadija could admire the secular Muslim culture of the north. And as Finnegan often said, the coffee on both sides was spectacular. If you didn't like Greek food, there was Turkish fare aplenty. And if you didn't like either, then you should die with a freezer full of tofu. Finnegan chose a Lebanese place on the south side, on the pedestrian-only thoroughfare, but tucked away enough to be invisible to the mainly Russian, British, and British Commonwealth tourists. Lebanese food is neutral, so Catalan's parents would have a hard time picking a fight over favoritism. Finnegan wore a relatively nice blazer and black trousers with loafers. He'd even shaved. He thought he looked urbane and sophisticated. Most everyone else thought he looked like a graduate student doing his impression of a grown-up. Fierro wore a flowing skirt of sky blue and a blush pink sweater under a jacket, with riding boots. The outfit made Finnegan grin. He was used to her in either bad girl leathers or power suits of midnight black. None of that wardrobe ever made an appearance when Fierro and her mom came within shouting distance of each other. Fierro could switch to a fashionable look in an instant and, with her hair in a low knot and parted in the middle, she immediately looked like she fit in as a stylish young Madrileña. Her tote bag felt uncomfortably light on her shoulder, no weapons. She wouldn't wear the hijab. She accepted her own lack of faith and didn't care if her parents had a problem with that. Finnegan didn't say anything, knowing that Fierro was subconsciously frustrated that her uber-liberal parents didn't protest her position on faith. They drove the Land Rover from Kyrenia to the northern sector of Nicosia, parking on the Turkish side near the Rokas Bastion, one of the rounded orlons that made the oval city wall look, from the air, like a giant gear. "Now look," Finnegan said, "this is important. I can't say it enough. Your parents like me. Don't embarrass me." She smiled brightly and took his elbow as they approached the Green Line checkpoint. "Go fuck a camel." Alejandro Fierro had flown in from Berlin, and Khadija Dahar had flown in from New York City. They'd taken separate cabs from the island's main airport, outside Larnaca, and arrived 30 minutes apart. Finnegan's choice of restaurants was inspired. They started with salads of tabbouleh and fattoush, then switched to spicy batata hara, meatballs and tomato sauce, fried cauliflower and halva, the sweet sesame paste studded with fruit and nuts, for dessert. Alejandro ordered Lebanese and Greek wines like the connoisseur he was. The couple adored Finnegan as the only man their daughter had ever brought home from her work. It was the work part that worried Fierro. To the world at large, the partners used the cover of St. Nicholas Salvage and Wrecking, a maritime recovery company. Thanks to the opaque and blatantly criminal nature of Cypriot banks and corporate law, they had successfully hidden their real job and real profits therein. But that wouldn't work for their parents. Neither Alejandro and Khadija, nor Finnegan's extended family, were likely to believe that either of them knew the first thing about maritime salvage. It had been their friend, Thomas Shannon Grayson, who'd come up with a cover for the families. As far as their kin knew, Finnegan and Fierro lived on Cyprus and worked as analysts for the European Union. They were pencil pushers in an obscure and enormous transnational government entity, gathering statistics on violence to help set policy in Brussels. The job had three advantages. First, it sounded far too boring for a lot of questions. Second, Fierro had been a soldier. Finnegan had been both a city cop and a U.S. Marshal. Their families might well believe they'd taken desk jobs that still revolved around the data of violence, if not real violence. And third, the EU is so massive, so bloated of personnel, that they ran little risk of their parents knowing someone who could rumble them. "So important, this work," Khadija Dahar said, speaking to Finnegan and not to her daughter, 3 inches of bangles jangling on each forearm. "Information is power. Those who gather information are every bit the soldiers as those with guns, more so." She sipped her wine. She might have been born Muslim, but she brought very few of the cultural taboos with her. Alejandro Fierro spoke at length about the tech revolution and the information economy, urging his daughter and the fine young American to think about what happens after their time as analysts for the EU. "I am glad, very glad that you chose civil service," he pronounced to his child. "When you joined the army, well, a waste of education and brilliance, alas." "When was that?" Finnegan asked, because it was his job to keep the light conversation moving forward, a skill his partner utterly lacked. "Right after the bombings, of course," Alejandro said. Catalan stiffened, a tension on her halva. "For the U.S. it was September 2001, but for the Spanish it was the train bombings in 2004. A week after, the crater still smoldering, and Catalan joined the military. Her mother..." Alejandro mimed his wife's head exploding. "No, no," Khadija interjected, reaching across the feast to pour wine into Finnegan's glass. "Service is important. I was honored, proud. Catalan's instincts were the instincts of any good citizen. Of course, I was pleased when she took a civilian position with the European Union, pleased that someone took notice of Catalan's intelligence and education, and knew instantly that she could best help with a computer, not crawling in some trench with a rifle. And here we are." Finnegan sipped his wine. "And here we are." Everyone toasted. Fierro finished her halva without glancing up from the table. Michael Finnegan wasn't an idiot. He'd never had any intention of going into business with anyone without doing a thorough background check, up to and most definitely including an illegal background check. He wasn't ever supposed to know Fierro's backstory. Indeed, almost no one did. Catalan Fierro Dahar had grown up as a complete jock. She'd crewed yachts in the Mediterranean. She'd played soccer. Football, he corrected himself. She competed in the biathlon, the competition that involved cross-country skiing and rifle shooting. Indeed, she'd made the Spanish national team before turning 19. But within 24 hours of the Madrid bombings of 2004, Fierro joined the Spanish army with the intention of being a soldier. But within the first weeks of boot camp, the recruiters for the Centro Nacional de Inteligencia realized they had something special in the intelligent, educated, and athletic young woman. Catalan could shoot. Period. This skill came to the attention of Hugo Llorente, the eminence grise of Spanish intelligence. For more than 3 decades, Llorente had run a quiet little bureau within CNI, with a forgettable budget and a low profile. Hundreds of bureaucrats in Madrid had fallen asleep over the department's turgid quarterly reports. None of them knew that Llorente's division was, to use the colloquialism of international intelligence, a kill shop. It was Hugo Llorente who first understood what they had in Catalan Fierro Dahar. Here was a woman who could shoot people. Could and did, and slept well enough afterward. Plus, she was a polyglot and stunning. The combination was too much for Llorente to turn down. Her transition into his elite intelligence unit had happened as soon as she turned 22. She stayed until she turned 28. There were no records anywhere of her confirmed kills. Michael Finnegan knew the right people, though. He pieced together her history as a shooter. 1 week after he confirmed her bona fides, the Turkish occupying government of northern Cyprus okayed the articles of incorporation for St. Nicholas salvage and wrecking. Chapter 11. Zagreb, Croatia. Lazar Aleksic rarely left Belgrade, Serbia, but his company wasn't based there. He owned a continent-spanning trucking company, Ragusa Logistics, which had its headquarters in Croatia, closer to the heart of Europe's international trucking lanes. Ever the cop, Finnegan wanted to find out everything he could about Aleksic's legitimate business before tackling his criminal enterprise. Finnegan bought a cappuccino for Fierro and an Americano for himself. He'd found them a lovely little cafe, an open-air affair under a striped awning, right on the great and vibrant central square, Jelicic Block, in the heart of Zagreb. A dizzying array of citizens and tourists flooded the square, taking photos or enjoying the sunny day, the townies moving with a mission, the visitors moving in circles. A strangely high percentage of the residents, both male and female, could be categorized as good-looking.
"Zagreb would be a good staging point for us," he said.
She sat hunched low, long legs under the table, dressed in black as always with classic Ray-Bans. "We're too far from Belgrade. We should be there." The northern half of the former Yugoslavia gets progressively more European as one moves west, and progressively more Slavic as one moves east, from Slovenia through Croatia to Bosnia-Herzegovina and finally Serbia. Signage on the west side of the country is in English and German and Italian. In the east, it's in English and Cyrillic. "Zagreb is good," he argued. "It gives us access to my police contacts and your military contacts in Europe. It gives us access to Ragusa Logistics." "Why do we care about his legitimate business?" Finnegan said. "He allegedly ships underage sex slaves around Europe." "I know we should be..." Her voice petered out. "Ships." "Yep." "Okay," she added begrudgingly. "I get that. Find out if he uses his own trucking company to move the victims. That's smart. But Aleksic himself isn't here. Shan's research said he never leaves Belgrade."
"Maybe we can find this Drayton Basha here," she shrugged.
"Maybe."
"Besides, nobody's friendlier than Zagrebians," he said.
"Zagrebites? Zagreboids? These people. Friendliest folks in Europe." She turned her head a couple inches his way, revealing his own reflection in her glasses. "Is there anything about me that leads you to believe that I like friendly people?" They sat and watched the crowd in the square for a while. Fierro sipped her coffee. They'd spent the better part of the previous 2 days learning everything they could of Aleksic's Ragusa Logistics. They'd watched the warehouse, made note of the comings and goings of trucks and drivers and warehousemen. The place appeared to be legit and likely was. Fierro ran a pianist's hand through her long, straight locks. He couldn't tell what she was looking at behind the glasses. She might have been looking at the lovely townies or the grinning tourists, or at the estimable general astride his marble horse. "Want to hear an interesting story? General Josip Jelicic," Finnegan pointed to the statue of the proud general. The cavalry officer wore the fine plumage of a conqueror and held his sword before him, facing east. The statue pivots on a single axis, so the general and his horse can face whichever nation is suspected of being the biggest threat to Croats at any given time. In the 19th century, he faced north, sneering at the Austro-Hungarians. After Tito fell and Yugoslavia disintegrated, they pivoted the statue to face east in order to intimidate the Serbians. Fierro slouched. She could fall asleep behind those very dark glasses, and he'd be none the wiser. A good minute passed, and a slow smile slid across the lower half of her features, appearing almost timidly beneath the glass frames. And finally, a laugh. That most coveted and rare of reactions. "You made that up." Finnegan used his contacts to find them an apartment with a kitchen, which would serve as their base camp. He didn't know any cops in Croatia, but he knew cops in a lot of other countries who vouched for him. They made inquiries about organized crime in the former Yugoslavia, but kept the name Lazar Aleksic out of it. He learned something useful. The heart and soul of the Eurozone was the Schengen Agreement. The deal was designed to facilitate international commerce throughout Europe, and it did. Spend 20 minutes on the German Autobahn, and you'd pass trucks from Poland and the Czech Republic, France and Portugal, Luxembourg and Lithuania, none of which are required to stop for inspection at international borders, provided they had the appropriate tags on their bumpers. And the trucks of Lazar Aleksic's Ragusa Logistics had all the right tags. When the partners figured they'd learned enough about Ragusa's trucks, warehouses, and offices in Zagreb, they bought a used Nissan for cash. They packed up their go bags and took a road trip due east to Belgrade, the capital of Serbia. Chapter 12. Belgrade, Serbia. The Club Obsidian was one of the city's most prosperous night spots, located on Boulevard Nikola Tesla. It had been built in the 19th century as a library with 30-foot-high ceilings and ornate Gothic design on every surface. The windows were narrow and a dozen feet high, and colored lights set outside and aiming upward through beams of blue and red and gold and green through the glass and toward the cathedral ceiling. A second floor had been designed in an atrium format, with iron grid walkways around all four sides, the center part of the building open from floor to ceiling. The floor was sectioned off into a dancing area, a seating area, and a low stage. Seven wet bars lined the four walls. Finnegan and Fierro arrived separately. He paid to get in. The bouncer let her in for free. After casing the place separately, they reconnected on the second floor. The din was so loud, Finnegan could feel the vibrations in his clavicle. "Nice joint," he leaned in and almost shouted in her ear. Fierro leaned toward him, and he could feel her hair on his neck. "Face the DJ, and you face Jerusalem," she said. "Face that bartender, and you face Mecca." He laughed. "You learn the damnedest things in a split-faith childhood." Finnegan had selected a black shirt and black jeans. Fierro hadn't changed a thing, which was fine. Her usual goth sensibility fit in well. She hadn't even removed her sunglasses. Both had been hit on several times, making their reconnoiter interesting, if cumbersome. They stood on the second floor, drinks in hand, near the ornate iron railing that dated to the origins of the building. The second-story iron catwalks had allowed the original library patrons to look down upon row after stately row of long tables with green-shaded, gooseneck desk lamps and severe high-backed chairs, and at the bibliophiles who held no truck with modern notions like microfiche or paperback tomes, but who preferred the aroma of paper mold. That was then. Today, Finnegan and Fierro looked down at the writhing, Boschian mass of dancers, swaying to a mix of Alicia Keys and Black Sabbath, bolted together uncomfortably but workably by an Asian girl on the DJ stand. She weighed maybe 90 pounds and had seen maybe 19 summers, and she wore one side of her earphones in place, the other against her neck, and sweated over the turntables like a thoracic surgeon over a chest wound. Spotlights pivoted and threw shafts of cobalt, magenta, and violet around the open space. Two drunken college boys sidled up to Fierro and asked her something in Serbian. Neither Finnegan nor Fierro spoke Serbian, but the most polite possible guess about their query was, "Want to dance?" Other, less polite options might have been possible, too. She turned her opaque glasses toward them and said, "No." They apparently understood that word, at least. She turned her head back toward Finnegan's cheek and spoke loudly. "Aleksic?" "Got him." "Where?" "Don't feel bad," he said. "I'm a trained law enforcement officer. I notice everything. See those couches down there at 10 o'clock? One of them's green? Check out the guy. Blonde with frosted highlights. He's got a champagne flute, and to his left is a bottle of what appears to be Cristal." Fierro stared through her shades at the bacchanal beneath them. She turned to Finnegan. "You're a trained observer?" "I am. Don't be ashamed." "And that's how you describe Aleksic, blonde with highlights. I should have mentioned that his black shirt appears to be silk and that more of the buttons are undone than is absolutely necessary. See, it's all in the details." Fierro sipped her vodka. "That's a good description." "Thank you. It's a skill set you develop over time." "Or you could have mentioned that he's getting a blowjob." "Nah," Finnegan said. See, that doesn't work as a description because as the evening goes on, our buddy Lazar will still be blonde with highlights and will still be wearing a black silk shirt. But the blowjob's got to end at some point. He sipped his whiskey. Presumably. Fierro barked a quick little laugh, and Finnegan felt good about that. Very few people ever made her laugh, and he chalked it up as a win. She leaned toward him and said, 10.
10 what?
Finnegan squinted as one of the gelled strobes dazzled them. He tried to figure out if Fierro was counting the muscle, clearly seated in proximity to Lazar Aleksic. He'd only spotted 4 of them. Then she said,
7.
7 what? She sipped her vodka.
5.
I don't... She nodded.
4, 3, 2.
Below them, Lazar Alex's face contorted, both eyebrows rising, his mouth a perfect oval. The young woman before him began to stand. Fierro said,
1.
Finnegan whistled, high, low. Now that is a skill set. She patted him on the shoulder and strolled away. Chapter 13. They separated and kept a discreet eye on Lazar Aleksic until he left Club Obsidian around 3. When the partners spotted the telltale signs of Aleksic getting ready to leave, they departed ahead of him. They sat in the Nissan a block away. A man of military bearing drove an Escalade up to the front of the club. 2 more muscular men escorted the youngster out of the club, along with a lustrous bit of silicone and peroxide in platform heels. The men glared at the other drivers and pedestrians.
Soldiers, Fierro said.
Finnegan held binoculars so small they fit into the palm of his hand.
Any idea who Dryden Basha is?
Finnegan shrugged. Right now, just a name from a stoner asshole ex-cop. Nobody I knew has ever heard of him. The Escalade started up. Fierro in the driver's seat turned over the engine of their Nissan. They turned down Kineza Milosha into the heart of the government district and headed toward the Stari Grad, or Old City. She was able to stay well back because the Escalade was so large and easily visible amid the traffic. All of the truck traffic around them bore logos in Cyrillic. A kilometer on, and Fierro spotted Aleksic's car begin to drift out of the lane. She pulled into an alley so quickly the car behind her honked. Ahead of them, the SUV ducked into the underground parking of a tall tower. Finnegan got a quick glimpse of the building before they pulled away. It was maybe 20 stories high, overlooking the Stari Grad and the intersection of the Danube and the Sava rivers. He spotted another likely soldier standing at the egress to the underground parking as a steel door rumbled upward, clearing the way. Then their Nissan was into the alley and the view was blocked. Fierro slow-rolled the car to the end of the alley so they could head back the way they'd come. Her plan was to reconnect to the same street they'd just abandoned and to do a leisurely drive-by of the tower. "We were told that Serbian mobsters are ex-military?" Finnegan asked.
"Yes.
These guys look ex to you?"
"No."
They traveled back in the opposite direction a few blocks, then reversed course again. "The choke point for any contraband, guns, drugs, children, is at the borders, right?" Fierro nodded. "So maybe Aleksic isn't working with retired military like the Serbian mob. Maybe he's working with current military."
"Serbian," she said, "or Kosovar."
"The refugees come through Greece, through Macedonia, through Kosovo, then here."
"And maybe this Dryden Basha's not some hood or a bent cop," she responded.
"Maybe he's active military." They often finished each other's sentences, but if asked, both would deny it ever happened. They cruised past the high-rise. Signs on the ground floor, in English and Serbian, advertised office space available for lease starting that coming autumn, as well as storefront retail space to let. The tower looked to be about 4/5 finished, the primary contractors probably going through their final punch lists. Tenants would start moving in within a month or two, except for the penthouse level. It was brightly lit, the only floor that was, looking like a lighthouse awaiting wayward sailors on a rocky shoal. "If Aleksic is supported by a standing army," Finnegan began,
"we need to see if McTavish is available.
And here's another thought." "Another thought," Finnegan chimed in with her. "Say Lazar Aleksic is working with the Kosovar military. That explains what they bring to the party. What does he bring to the party?" They both said,
Money, Finnegan said. That, and connections. Links to the rest of Europe. Links to the criminal underground. Dark money? They looked at each other and spoke in harmony. Ways and means.
Chapter 14. Turkey. Jane Hoori and Tamara Wad made it across to the Red Cross, Red Crescent transit point and into Turkey. Mohammed and Amira Bakur did as well. Their parents did not. There was some sort of glitch with their paperwork. Jane couldn't figure out what exactly it was. But Tamer had had an inkling that something like this might happen, and he'd armed the kid's father with a prepaid mobile flip phone and charger just in case. Tamer and Jane had a matching phone, and they had programmed the reciprocal numbers into each. Jane and Tamer talked to the parents at length, while Mohammed glowered and Amira cried. There was no way of knowing when the parents would get through. It could take days. Meanwhile, a cousin was waiting far, far to the west with a boat to take the family across the Aegean to Greece. Not a raft either, a proper freighter with a professional crew. A boat that wouldn't wait forever. Jane and Tamar could no more cross south back into Syria than their parents could make the crossing north. It was finally decided, after calls to Jane's uncle, that the journalists would stay with the kids for the transit of Turkey and the crossing of the Aegean. The kids, along with the journalists, would reunite with their parents in Greece. They had a dozen other family members waiting for them there. Jane and Tamer and Mohammed and Amira Bakur boarded a train. While most of the families they'd traveled with were heading northwest toward Ankara and across the Bosporus and onto Bulgaria, the journalists and the teenage siblings headed due west.
Chapter 15. Belgrade. Major Drayton Basha of the Kosovo Security Force pulled off the main highway at Vrčin, a suburb of Belgrade, and tooled around the main drag toward a series of garages that cater to international trucking. He'd made the trip several times and did so now by rote. A transponder on his dashboard opened a rolling chain-link gate. The Quonset hut within offered no signage, the corrugated metal rusty and weather-racked. One truck stood back a bit, invisible from the main street. It was adorned with international transit tags on the bumper and the stenciled logo of Ragusa Logistics on the driver's door. A sergeant in Basha's KSF unit waited outside the hut, smoking. He wore civilian clothes, the same as Basha.
"Major," he snapped to attention as Basha climbed out of his civilian vehicle. "How many?"
"Four, sir."
Basha said, "Give me one of those." The sergeant smiled and proffered the pack, plus matches. He waited while the major lighted up.
"They're not what we were expecting, sir."
Basha's eyebrows rose. He rarely showed much emotion in front of his men.
"How so?"
"Older, sir, 18, maybe 20. Basha took a drag on the cigarette, cursing silently.
"Show me."
The sergeant unlocked the door behind him. The interior of the Quonset hut was gutted. Vacant except for a couple of cots and an old cable spool that made for a passable table. It was hot inside, the air danced with visible dust fibers. Likely asbestos, Basha assumed, but then again, no soldier is ever guaranteed a long life. Wax paper had been applied to the windows, letting in weak, milky light but maintaining privacy. By the dim light, he studied the four refugees who stood or sat around the spool, staring back at him. Three men and a woman. A surprisingly tall scarecrow of a woman, actually. Their clothes were disheveled. Each had a rucksack, set on the floor but not too far from their feet. They were around 18 or 19 years old. They were Iraqi, although Basha only knew that because he'd been told that a wave of Iraqi immigrants had just hit the border between Kosovo and Montenegro the day before.
"Who gathered them?" Basha asked.
"Corporal Yumnika," the sergeant said, shaking his head sadly. The four Iraqis stared at the soldiers, uncomprehending. One of the men asked a question in Arabic. Neither Basha nor his sergeant spoke the language.
"Yumnika is no genius."
The sergeant smiled.
"No, sir." "So the concept of pedophilia?"
"He's not a bad soldier," the sergeant said. "He's an idiot, but he's not a bad soldier."
A second male refugee seemed to ask them a question. The air was hot and decidedly unhealthy in the hut. So Basha and his sergeant stepped back outside into the sunshine.
The sergeant relocked the metal door.
"They're no good for the traffickers," Basha said. "There's a factory outside Bratislava that will take them as workers. Ship them to this man."
He paused, pulled out an old parking ticket out of his wallet, and dashed a name and address for a commercial site on the west side of the Italy-Slovenia border, north of Trieste.
"You'll keep them until the Slovak warehouse can be contacted. They won't net us what the bordellos do, not a tenth as much, but that's no reason to be wasteful."
"Very good, sir." Basha walked to his car and climbed in.
"Sergeant, get them some water," he said. "A dead refugee is worth fuck all on the open market."
"Right away, sir." Basha got back onto the highway, but it was barely a 20-minute drive into Belgrade proper. He turned off onto the street that led to the parliament building, Kneza Miloša. Just past the grand opulence of the Church of St. Sava, he spotted the almost-finished high-rise office building. A KSF soldier stood guard outside and called in to have the garage door opened. Basha pulled onto the darkened ramp and swept swiftly downward into the underground parking. His car and his partner's fleet were the only vehicles in the vast, echoing space designed for several hundred cars. Lazar's fleet included an armored Escalade, a glistening silver Jaguar, several high-end American motorbikes that the kid couldn't ride, and a beastly metallic Hummer that dwarfed the others, including the Cadillac. Basha took the stairs to the lobby and walked up to the unfinished concierge's desk, where another guard stood on detail.
"Major!"
Basha scanned the lobby. The acoustic tiles had not yet been installed, and wires hung in lazy loops from the spaces above, in between the air ducts. Rolls of industrial carpet were stacked in one corner.
"Did he get in last night?"
the guard said.
"He's in, sir," in a tone that conveyed his annoyance.
"Alone?"
"He's with one of his whores, sir."
Basha stared at the soldier, who stood at attention and took the look without comment.
"Sergeant, no one is supposed to—"
Basha's voice trailed away. He ran a calloused hand through his iron-gray hair.
"God, it's like babysitting a child.
All right, send me up." The sergeant used his walkie-talkie to call upstairs to the penthouse suite, the only floor currently functioning in the high-rise owned, via several cut-out corporations, by Ragusa Logistics. Once tenants began moving in, the elevators would be functional on every floor. For now, they were controlled from the penthouse only, and one of Basha's Kosovar troops manned the station at all times. Basha turned and marched toward the elevator bank. Lazar Aleksic had just done a line of coke as Major Drayton Basha stepped out of the elevator. Lazar grinned at the taller man, then nodded toward the mirror and the razor on the coffee table before him.
"No, thank you," Basha said.
Lazar slouched back on the butterscotch-colored leather couch. He wore black dress trousers but was barefoot and shirtless. His straw-blonde hair stood up on end, complementing the pillow creases on his otherwise smooth cheek. He had a surfer's lean physique and easy smile.
"You should have seen the hoe spinning at the Obsidian last night. She was off the chain."
Basha nodded, understanding none of it.
"You sure you don't want some?"
Lazar nudged the coffee table with the sole of one bare foot.
"Plenty."
"No.
I heard from my unit at the Macedonian border. We—"
Lazar nodded toward the master suite.
"There's a girl in there. Best you ever had. She's asleep, but she won't mind if you want to throw a quick fuck into her."
Basha stood silently. He wanted to pinch the boy's head off his shoulders, but then again, he always wanted to do that. If Lazar Aleksic wasn't the key to all their profits, he might have.
"I heard from my unit on the Macedonian border," he said. "We are expecting a shipment."
Lazar yawned and scratched his bare chest.
"How many?"
"How many do you have buyers for?"
"I could place six girls, right now."
He snapped his fingers to show how easy it would be. "Boys are tougher.
Two."
"No, I could place four."
Basha nodded.
"Six girls, four boys. You have buyers for them lined up?"
Lazar's eyes glazed over. He said,
"I want a McMuffin."
"I'll have one of the men go.
Actually, I want to go to Berlin. Jay-Z is playing there. I love Jay-Z. I want to go tonight."
"Impossible," the major replied softly. "Bullshit. I'm rich. I can do whatever I want. Bring bodyguards. Bring as many as you want. Come yourself. You like Jay-Z?"
Basha shook his head.
You have too many enemies. Your family has too many enemies. I can't protect you outside of Belgrade. Well, I'm going, so figure it out.
Basha took a deep breath.
How quickly can you get confirmation from your buyers?
A petulant cloud formed over the youth's fair features. He started to respond as the door to the master suite opened. A girl padded out. She had very large hair and very large breasts, and she wore one of Lazar's t-shirts, but nothing else. She crossed the living room and leaned over the back of the butterscotch couch. Lazar turned toward her, and they kissed passionately. Bent at the waist, the t-shirt slipped up over her ass. They separated. Lazar squeezed one breast.
Go say hi to Drayton. He's my friend.
Giggling, she circled the couch and sidled up to the soldier.
God, you're tall, Drayton. What kind of name?
Basha spun the girl around to face Lazar. He drew a narrow steel dagger from a shoulder-strapped sheath. It looked more like an ice pick than a combat knife, and drove it into her chest, just under her lowest rib, and angled up to pierce her heart. The tough, thin blade met no resistance. Slicing through cheese would have been harder. He withdrew the slim blade. Blood began to spread on her shirt. She opened her mouth wide, eyes wide, and her muscles went statue rigid. No sound escaped.
Jesus!
Lazar tried scrambling over the back of the couch to get distance from the nightmarish sight. Basha held the girl. The red blossom grew on her abdomen, but not really that much. She made an inhaling sound through her open mouth, and her eyes rolled back up into her skull. He released his hold on her, and she fell straight down. The stain on her t-shirt grew a little. Basha knew how to make sure the blood from her heart leaked into her chest cavity, for the most part. There are times when one wants blood gushing to send a message, and times when one wishes to avoid a mess.
Fuck!
Lazar screeched. He pointed. What?
I would have preferred she not hear my name or see my face, Basha said.
He nudged the girl's rump with the toe of his boot. She rolled the hip forward an inch, then rolled right back, inert.
Six girls, four boys, and I assume your buyers would prefer them to be well under the age of 16, if possible.
Yes,
Lazar bellowed, his hands shaking.
Jesus, fuck, yes, 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 on the girls, maybe four boys, I think.
You said four boys. I can move them.
Basha nodded. Good, I'll call my unit.
Lazar sprinted for the kitchen, and a second later, Basha heard him puke in the sink.
Basha sighed and drew his Nextel phone, activating the walkie-talkie feature.
We have a mess to clean up, and a body. Over.
Copy, Major. And contact Lieutenant Krasnichi in Eles Han. Tell him six girls, four boys.
Sir.
Basha returned his phone to his pocket. He knelt and wiped the long, thin pick on the girl's t-shirt. He checked his own sleeves and hands, no splatter. Still crouched over the body, he spoke up.
We'll have the product ready by the end of the week.
I understand.
The voice from the kitchen was choked with vomit and emotion.
Good.
Basha rose to his full height, returned the stiletto to its shoulder sheath.
I'll talk to you tonight.
At the elevator, he turned and shouted,
My regards to your family.
He heard Lazar Alexich puke again. Chapter 16. Varenna, Italy. Günter Kessler had committed many, many crimes during his time at the Zurich branch of Banque du Monte Rosa. So many, in fact, that the bank faced a dilemma. Commit one banking crime and you'll get fired. Commit a handful and you'll go to prison. But commit scores of them, if not hundreds, all in the name of a centuries-old financial establishment, and they have no option but to take the most dramatic response. Promote you, and then hide you. Banque de Monte Rosa of Zurich needed a nice, quiet place to store Günter Kessler, where no international tribunal would look for him. They opted for the quaint lakeside village of Varenna on Lago di Como in northwest Italy, within sight of Swiss mountains. Other than the daily inflow of tourists, via ferry from Como or by train, no businessman ever ventured to Varenna. It seemed the perfect depot to hide a man whose deplorable acts had netted you millions upon millions in profit. Günter Kessler remained on the books as a low-level bank employee. He was free to maintain the various illegal projects he'd created for the bank and to seek out other clients. One of those clients was St. Nicholas Salvage and Wrecking. And like his other private clientele, the partners of St. Nicholas referred to him simply as Ways and Means. Michael Finnegan flew back to Milan, commercial, and caught the train from Malpensa directly to Lake Como, coming up on the eastern side of the idyllic mountain lake. He arrived a little past noon. With only a messenger bag, Finnegan hopped off the train first and rolled on downhill into the narrow, shore-hugging community. He walked with the bandy-legged gait of his father and his uncles, as if walking the beat was in the family DNA. He tried to imagine his sister, Nicole, walking a beat, but failed. He looked scruffy enough that none of the hucksters offered him maps or kites or tchotchkes. He'd called ahead and thus found Gunther at his usual table in a small tea shop, looking dejected. The banker was small and tubby, bald and badly nearsighted. He wore shabby suits and bought inexpensive eyeglasses online to save money. Finnegan knew from past visits that the man would sit in the shop for hours, reusing the same tea bag until it was reduced to little more than a mesh net and pencil shavings. No one passing by would suspect that Ways and Means was a criminal mastermind whose personal net worth was in the tens of millions. The lake looked placid today, and one of three ferries making the rounds, like an aquatic crosstown bus, pulled into the dock, the crew shouting, "Varenna!" as if it were three words. There was little to do in Varenna, so nobody was in a hurry to get to it. Those tourists not sauntering the Candyland-like trail along the curvy shore sat on beaches and read, or knelt to line up photographs. Finnegan entered, the bell over the door tinkling, and sat on the far side of the heart-shaped table, on the uncomfortable metal chair with the heart-shaped back. Ways and Means bobbed an aging tea bag and a cup of lightly browned water and peered through his thick lenses at the young man. Finnegan reached into his messenger bag, looked around to make sure they were undetected, and pulled out a stained paper bag. Inside lay three glazed Krispy Kremes, FedExed from a shop in Secaucus, New Jersey, where his niece worked. Ways and Means peered into the bag and sighed. "This will probably kill me." "Probably. How you doing?" The egg-shaped man shrugged. "It could be worse. I'm not sure how, but..." The shop owner came, and Finnegan asked for a cappuccino. He looked out the window at the slow-footed tourists, several of whom sat under umbrellas, wine glasses in hand. You could physically see people unwind in a town like this, as if a vice grip was being loosened somewhere on their spines. "You're doing okay?" Finnegan knew to ask again about the man's health. It was expected of him. "I am in exile, serving my sentence for nothing but this." Ways and Means gestured at the window and the paradise beyond. "Yeah, that's tough. Last month, I had a scheme to hide some elected officials' money in the little-known firm in Iceland, a nice little mineral exploratory company. Nothing fancy. I thought they might make 3.2% interest. Who knows? Could have done better." Ways and Means broke off a bit of doughnut and gobbled it down. It might have tasted like paper for all his facial features showed. "Do you know what happened? The idiots in Iceland discovered chromium. Chromium! My elected officials made 340% interest in a month. Now they're rich and I have to find another obscure company to launder their new profits. I ask you, is that fair?" Finnegan never knew whether the small, fat man was joking. Every time they met, he had another hideous tale of ludicrous good luck. "Sisyphus has got nothing on you, man." He grunted around another mouthful of doughnut. Sitting as he did, a couple feet from a display case of the finest pastries in all of the Italian lake region. "Sisyphus tried to roll a stone uphill. I do that while passing a stone. But what of St. Nicholas? How is Catalin?" "She's good. I'm in love with her. You know this. Most everyone is. What can I do for you?" Finnegan glanced around the shop to make sure they had some privacy. He leaned forward across the painted pink and white table. "How do I go about buying underage sex slaves from Syria here in Europe?" "What price range are you thinking?" Finnegan sat back. "Really?" The other man blinked through thick glasses. "That's your question? I ask about underage sex slaves, and you ask about my price range?" The fat man shrugged. "I should have started with gender." "You're the most morally hollow human being I've ever met."
Ways and Means shook his head, his jowls quivering. No, no, you're too kind. There are many less moral men than myself. Some come by it quite naturally. I do what I can, but there's something very wrong with you. I am not a fool, Michael. You and the delightful Catalan are bounty hunters. I am a banker. I can put two and two together. Finnegan shook his head. Okay. We think the mob in Belgrade is moving refugee children on the flesh market. We think the army is involved. Maybe the Serbian army, maybe Kosovo's army. Catalan is checking that angle. I want to follow the money. Vise, the banker said and sighed with fatigue. The bag in front of him was empty. Refugees coming via Greece? Through the Balkans? Yeah. And ending up in European bordellos? The worst kinds of bordellos, the kinds willing to barter in the slave market. Ways and Means sat back. There might be a way to find out which criminally-minded bankers are moving Serbian dinars and exchanging them with euros, or bitcoins. If I knew that, I might be able to identify a location on the broker's end. Finnegan started to smile. Yeah, that might work. I look into it. Do you need any emergency capital? Maybe. If we could figure out who's brokering for the buyers, we could pose as potential customers. We'd have to wave around some green. Yeah, we might. The other man shrugged. I can provide you with quite a bit of money. I'm in need of laundering some, so. If we bought several slaves, I don't know, a whole shipment, we might be in a position to demand a meeting with the seller. If we flash some bucks, Finnegan said, thinking out loud, whatever you need. Thanks, man. I have no adventures of my own. And speaking of which, may I ask a question? St. Nicholas, I assume you chose the company name to connote the good feelings of Christmas? Why not, he said. Let's go with that theory. The German let out a long, morose sigh. Kidnapping refugee children. Terrible business. I know, right? He pushed back his chair and stood, reaching for his wallet. Ways and Means never paid for these meetings. Their profit margin would be so much higher if they just used narcotics on local runaways. I can never tell when you're joking. Chapter 17. Tel Aviv, Israel. While Finnegan went to follow the money, Fiero drove back west toward Zagreb. From there, she drove down the Dalmatian coast to the seaside town of Rijeka, Croatia, and rendezvoused with the laconic Lachlan Sumner and their de Havilland daughter. They flew to Tel Aviv. The flyby was a bar near the airport, the kind of place that looked like either health officials had recently shut it down or they should have. It was the Israeli equivalent of a biker bar, only instead of bikers, it catered to mercenary soldiers, which meant the flyby was among Tel Aviv's most profitable watering holes. Fiero had been there several times and was greeted by silent nods and a few raised glasses. The flyby might have been a place where everybody knows your name, but the soldier-for-hire business isn't keen on using people's names in public. She told the Ethiopian girl behind the bar that she was there for Jones. She was directed to a private nook behind the room with the pool tables. The nook was large enough for only two booths, and one was empty. The space stank of stale beer and fried food. She entered, waited for his eyes to adjust to the gloom. Brody McTavish stood and crushed Fiera with a bear hug, literally lifting her boots off the grimy floor. He stood 6'6" and was built like a Chevy engine block, with a full beard and a tangled mane of hair. "Jesus, but it's you," he bellowed. "You look a sight." They sat, and McTavish poured her a glass of cheap yellow beer. He smacked her on the shoulder with a hand the size of a tetherball. Fiero half suspected she'd have a bruise come morning. "It's good to see you, and that's a fact. How have you been?" "Good," she said. "Maisie?" He puffed up his chest at the mention of his daughter. "Accepted into a nursing program in Aberdeen." "She's 12," Fiero laughed. "She's 18 if she's a day. But it's true she sat on your lap in a few bars worse than this hellhole." They talked about family and about cohorts. They toasted those who died, a longer list than either liked to admit. McTavish had served in the Royal Dragoon Guards, an armored cavalry regiment of Her Majesty's Army, and had gone into the gun-for-hire business almost two decades earlier. That made him a rare kind of mercenary, the kind in his 50s. He'd plied his trade throughout Africa, the Middle East, the Far East, and South Africa,
and for the past 3 years, Brody McTavish and his band of criminals had been on retainer with St. Nicholas Salvage and Wrecking. One night, over pitchers of rum drinks in a Jamaican dive in Paris, Judge Betancourt's aide-de-camp, Shan Grayson, had asked about the wisdom of employing a feckless gunhand whose loyalty could be bought on the open market. A very drunk Michael Finnegan had explained it like this. They say that if the only tool in your toolbox is a hammer, then every problem looks like a nail. I'm a cop. I'm a really good investigator. Catelyn's a spook. She has a gift for getting into anywhere and getting anyone to say anything. But sometimes we're going to need big guys with an absence of morals and lots of guns. Or put it another way, we're going to need hammers, because not every problem is a nail, but sure as shit, some are. Now, in the flyby bar outside Tel Aviv, Fierro made sure they had the alcove to themselves, then leaned in close to the big Scotsman with the Viking beard and crazy hair. Any luck tracking down that name? He drained his glass and refilled it from the pitcher. Drayton Basha, I don't know him, but I found some men who do.
And?
Kosovo, McTavish pronounced it as three distinct words with three very long vowels, like he was practicing an alien tongue. Klingon, maybe. Flyspeck Nation, the old country of you-go-fuck-yourself. Has its own military these days. Kosovo's security force. Replace the blue helmets of KFOR. Fierro knew the reference. International troops under the banner of the United Nations, the so-called blue helmets, had been stationed in the former Yugoslavia since the 1990s. In UN parlance, they'd been known as the Kosovo Force, or KFOR.
What do you know about him?
Major, corrupt bastard, lining his own pockets, of course, but the pockets of his men, too, so they're fiercely loyal to him. Supposed to be a good feckin' soldier, from what I hear.
We think he's part of an underground railroad, kidnapping Middle Eastern children and selling them to brothels. But one thing doesn't track. Kosovo's a Muslim country, isn't it? You'd think they'd find someone else to abuse.
It's split, McTavish said. Country's got Islam, got Catholicism, got Eastern Orthodox, yeah? The northern region of the country is ethnically Serbian. This Basha, he runs an elite unit out of Operating Base Sar, which is in that Serbian region. And his unit's entirely Eastern Ortho. There's a faction in the government wanted it that way. Not everyone's happy about it, but there it is.
McTavish paused to glug his beer and wiped his mustache with the back of his hand. He managed not to emote any moral outrage at the concept of child prostitution. He earned a living selling his gun hand, which made it problematic to be judgmental of others.
What should I know about the Kosovo Security Force? Fierro asked.
As good and bad as any man's army. Trained some damn good soldiers. Major Basha's unit, I'm reliably told, is stocked with good fighters with good discipline. You'll not be facing weekend warriors with the likes of them. Go up against Basha and you'll see some true soldiers.
Fierro considered the situation. She sipped her beer. It was vile, warm and flat. McTavish drained and refilled his again.
Are your men available?
Will be. Heading to the Sudan tomorrow. Hired to get some petroleum boffins in and out of the Nuba Mountains.
Good luck with that.
Won't need luck, he flashed a smile and two gold teeth. Won't turn it down, it comes my way, but I never count on it.
Wise lad, when are you done in Sudan?
2 weeks, maybe three.
Fierro reached into the beat-up leather satchel she'd carried into the bar and withdrew a buff envelope so fat that the red drawstring barely reached the metal grommet. She shoved it across the bar. It soaked up spilled beer as it went.
Don't take any commissions once you get done with the petroleum boys, she said. I have a feeling we may need you.
We go up against them Kosovo fuckers. We'll want 1.5 our regular rates. They got arms, got training, got discipline. Plus Major Basha's line in their pockets. Gives a man incentive to fight well, that.
Fierro said.
Done.
McTavish raised his glass and she raised hers, and his glass slopped over as he caromed them against each other. She caught a glimpse of a tattoo on McTavish's bulging biceps. Irimabo ilis non acepare iocas. Her Latin was rusty, but she was pretty sure it meant, fuck 'em if they can't take a joke. Chapter 18. Kosovo. Major Drayton Basha had just cleared his own checkpoint, his jeep rolling into the dusty, flat territory of Kosovo, where his sat phone blinked to life.
He pulled over and checked the incoming scroll. It was his unit captain, Stevan Sorak. Rasha checked to see if the encryption button was lit up, then responded,
"Go."
"News on the buyer, sir."
He said, "Six of one flavor, four of the other."
Sorak had been with the operation since it started, and there was no need to translate flavor. Lazar Alexich had lined up buyers for six girls and four boys.
"We're hearing rumors of suicide bombers on this side of the Aegean," Sorak said. "It could mean quite the influx of product. You know what they say about blood on the street."
"When there's blood on the street, there's profit to be made.
Tell Lieutenant Krasnichi to concentrate on six and four for now. But yes, round up as many as he likes. We can, bank them, in case anything happens with our buyers."
Drayton Basha and Stevan Sorak both had concerns about their long-time reliance on Lazar Alexich. The youth was just too volatile for their tastes.
"Understood. One other thing, sir."
"Go ahead."
"I've got some men running the trap lines in Syria, Jordan, and Lebanon, making sure none of the, stock gets noticed, you know?"
Basha put the jeep in gear and pulled back onto the dusty road.
"Go on."
"The men are in Tel Aviv now. Said the merc named McTavish was asking about you."
"About me?"
Alarmed, Basha had never been in Israel.
"Yes, sir. What about me?"
"Dunno, sir, just inquiring."
"What do you know about this McTavish?"
"Old school merc, sir. Worked in every hot spot on the globe, just a gun for hire."
"A gun for hire inquiring about me. Sir."
Basha considered this news, driving one-handed, chewing his lower lip. He didn't like it, not at all.
"Find out all you can about this McTavish. Find out if he's got regular clients, who his friends are, who he works for."
"Sir," Captain Sorak said.
Basha disconnected without a word and underhanded the sat phone into the passenger seat. Chapter 19. Belgrade. Finnegan got back to Serbia before Fiero, who had farther to travel, and decided to look into the unfinished high-rise building on Kneza Miloša, where they'd last seen the sleazy boy wonder, Lazar Alexich, after he'd left the disco. The guards outside the garage entrance and in the lobby suggested that Alexich and his partners controlled the whole building. That made it of interest. Belgrade is a working-class city, leaning more toward industry and commerce than tourism. The Stari Grad, or Old Town itself, featured a lovely cliffside castle, but history buffs looking for crenellated old world walls, or Roman ruins, or the onion domes of Eastern Orthodoxy came away disappointed. The iconic images of Old Town Belgrade were McDonald's, Sephora, and Abercrombie & Fitch. He again noticed that the trucks all bore Cyrillic advertising and logos. Very few seemed to have English or German writing on them. The truck traffic in Croatia, on the other hand, had featured every language in Europe. He went online to figure out why. Later, he walked a four-block-by-four-block perimeter with a high-rise in the center, discreetly taking cell phone photos from every angle. He stopped at every open door and asked if the proprietors spoke English. If they did, he engaged them in some basic banter, eventually rolling around to the subject of the unfinished building in their neighborhood. Over the course of a late morning and a full afternoon, Finnegan discovered that the building had been four-fifths finished for well over 2 years. The signs advertising imminent move-in opportunities had been adjusted several times to keep the dates in the future. People didn't know for sure why the buildings had remained unfinished, but everyone had an opinion. The Americans, City Hall, Jews, Bosnians, the United Nations, the Russian Mafia, Romanians. As the afternoon morphed into evening, he picked up a tale. Two guys, both young and both physically fit. After hitting a mobile phone shop, Finnegan reversed course and returned to a sporting goods store he'd walked into hours earlier. The entire front half of the shop was dedicated to soccer. Not surprising in this part of the world. He wandered a bit, finding sections dedicated to outdoor activities such as fishing and archery, plus a section of cricket equipment, then track and field wear, and finally, to his surprise, a darkened corner with a short shelf of baseball equipment. He found a college student behind the checkout counter and asked if he spoke English. The kid stuck a pencil behind his ear, dragged his head out of a biology textbook, and nodded.
"I gotta ask, why baseball? Does anyone play baseball in Serbia?"
The student shrugged. Some, not much. We don't sell shit from that section, Finnegan said.
Your lucky day, then, and handed the kid a wad of Serbian dinars and an aluminum baseball bat.
The staff sergeant on security detail at the Ragusa Logistics Tower got a call from a local merchant saying someone had been asking questions. The merchant had been paid to make this call in the event that anyone came sniffing around. They weren't worried about Belgrade police. Lazar Aleksic had bought and paid for the inspector who ran Belgrade's major crimes unit. Anyway, today's snoop appeared to be American, the merchant said. The staff sergeant sent down two of his five men on duty, a corporal and a private. The men were dressed as civilians, like everyone on the detail. Major's orders while working in Belgrade. It didn't take the men long to find the snoop. It was an unshaven guy with wavy hair that hung over his collar. He wasn't large, maybe 5'8 and wiry. They followed him from a sandwich shop to a mobile phone store, and from there to a sporting goods outlet. The clerk in the sandwich shop identified the man as an American and described him as friendly and chatty. They'd spoken about nothing in particular.
Did he ask about the office building over there? The corporal asked.
Yes, that, but also lots of things.
The men got the same story from the mobile phone place.
When the American didn't emerge from the sporting goods store, the soldiers entered and looked around. They checked every aisle. When they didn't find the man, they asked the long-haired kid behind the counter. The kid had his nose buried in a book, his fingers yellow from highlighter pens.
American? Yeah, a few minutes ago.
He left? The corporal asked.
I guess everyone leaves.
They asked about a back door and were told there was one, but it was always locked. They checked it out, unlocked and partially open. They stepped out into an alley. A mountain of broken-down cardboard boxes towered over them. Several old-style corrugated aluminum garbage cans stood about, half with their lids missing. They could hear the thrum of traffic on Knesset Milosha, 50 meters away.
You go left, I'll...
The corporal's leg exploded in pain. He collapsed, blacking out for a moment, coming to with his forehead in a muddy puddle on the ground. His eyes opened to see the private fly into the mountain of cardboard, which created an avalanche partially covering his body. Electric pain jolted from his knee up through his hip into his spine. He found that he was holding his knee but didn't remember doing so. A pair of legs appeared before his eyes, plus an American-style baseball bat. The corporal tried to roll over, and the baseball bat disappeared. A flash of pain hit him near his kidney, and his long muscles locked in spasm. He felt hands on his hips, felt his gun leave his holster and his wallet leave his trousers. He blacked out again, and when he opened his eyes, saw the American crouching by the pile of cardboard boxes, deftly disassembling a handgun. The corporal noticed his own, broken-down Glock 17 lying in the puddle near his face. Inhaling felt like trying to swallow tarmac. He lay there groaning. Even that hurt. The American crouched, his back to the corporal, and stuffed two wallets in his coat pocket. He used the private's own shirt to wipe down the baseball bat, then tossed it into one of the garbage cans. The man stood and sauntered away, with the rolling, bandy-legged strut of a sailor. The corporal wasn't sure, but he thought the American was whistling. Chapter 20 Volos, Greece. Thessaly, Greece. A displaced persons camp on the Greek coast north of Athens was rocked Thursday when a suicide bomber detonated a vest of explosives at a Red Crescent medical tent. Officials say the death toll stands at 15, but is expected to rise. Scores of people were injured, mostly Syrians fleeing the fighting back home. Jane Hoori huddled behind the chassis of an overturned Hyundai truck. The left rear wheel continued to turn, driven by an engine that, miraculously, hadn't stalled when the vehicle flipped on its side. She held Mohammed and Amira Bakur tight against her. Both kids were crying, and so was Jane. The ringing in her ears was painful and rose and fell in waves. Peered through the thick smoke, looking for Tamer Awad. At some point, someone yanked on her arm hard, trying to make her stand. Jane peered up and realized it was Mohammed. The 15-year-old stood, holding her arm in both of his small hands. "We have to go," he shouted. The ringing had diminished. Amira stood too, tears pouring down her cheeks. Jane realized she'd passed out.
"Are you all right?" she asked.
"There are trucks leaving. We have to go."
The boy tugged at her arm. Jane may have been petite,
but he couldn't budge her from leaning back against the oil-smeared chassis of the truck.
You have cousins here. We need to... Where's Tamer?
Jinan, Muhammad shouted, planted his feet and yanked. Ow, she started to stand up straight. The earth spun. She fell, shook her head, and began again. Where's Tamer?
I don't know, Jinan. I saw the boy who... The killer, I saw him.
She stared at Muhammad, who was doing his level best to, as her friends would have said back home, man up.
The boy with the backpack?
She'd seen him too, heading purposefully into the Red Crescent tent, wearing a quilted jacket too large and warm for the weather.
I saw him, Muhammad said. He wasn't alone. Jinan, he was with others. Come on.
She stumbled to her feet, gripped Amira close to her chest. The girl's entire body shook with sobs, and she held her right arm tight against her abdomen.
Come on, Jane said, and began circling the smashed truck. Come on.
She was speaking English now, but didn't realize it. Muhammad understood, and together they led his little sister away from the dead and the injured. Jane stepped over a smoldering bag in the dirt, and part of a human arm still entwined in the shoulder strap. She saw soldiers with UN blue caps waving them forward. She joined the throng, holding the little girl against her side as if to staunch the flow of blood from an imaginary wound. Muhammad clung to her, too. She'd gone almost 30 steps before her brain registered the arm and smoldering bag in the dirt. The ratty canvas camera bag, with the duct tape around the shoulder strap that she'd come to know so well.